I thought I would bring ample sermon notes so that I don't run out of material. Those are my reference works. And I'll keep you guessing on what it might be until we refer to them. I would like to thank the Wiener girls. We will certainly miss you. But I'm sure you'll be around and come back, or at least I hope so. I thought I would start today's sermon by going to a psalm that forms the basis of the message that connects with the ceremony that we have just performed. Let's turn over to Psalms chapter 127. And we're going to read it in its entirety, because I think it is a fitting backdrop and contrast by which to measure the current standards of our world. And I think it's important for us to do that, because we become influenced by the culture and attitude that is extended around us. That's just a natural consequence. Psalms chapter 127, beginning in verse 1, says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it." And here we see that God is the ultimate builder. And, of course, this is often cited, as we often do, and I'm not suggesting that it's inappropriate. It is often cited in isolation. I want to read the entirety of this, and then we'll come back and comment on things. "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate." I love that phrase at the end. They're not shaken, they're not ashamed, and they're prepared to meet their enemies in the gate with confidence. I find it interesting and instructive to see that in this psalm, which is one of the Psalms of Ascents, that was read prior to going up or on the way up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, it is interesting to me to see that in the context of the Lord building a house and guarding a city, the blessing of children are mentioned in that connection. There is a connection I hope to illustrate today, not the primary purpose, but at least by way of passing. There is a connection between the strength of a nation and a city and children. And when a nation begins to not value the next generation, or worse, which is the biggest crime of our culture today, abort them, it will affect the economic and military strength of a nation as well. And right here in this particular psalm, as short and concise as it might be, we see that connection made. If we do not value children, and if we do not recognize that they are, as it's described here, a heritage from the Lord, a reward, and that they are to bring happiness, and that we are not to be ashamed of them, it will affect the very strength of the family, and by extension, our community and our country. So that at some point it becomes vain to hold watch, And it becomes vain to build a house because the Lord is not building it. The value of children being diminished is a comparatively recent phenomenon. I mean, most cultures going back in time valued kids. I mean, depending on, you know, your perspective, I mean, there's never a perfect generation. But certainly in the last 30 years and in the last 50, a lot has changed in that respect, just in the number of kids that we have. So I have taken from this, there are five reasons embedded in these two scriptures on why children are a blessing. Five reasons. The first one we have already looked at, children are a heritage from the Lord. It doesn't say that children are a heritage. It says that it is a heritage given to you from God. That sounds pretty special, doesn't it? And I shudder to think what God thinks when we consider children anything but that. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 1 and notice the very beginning when God created man. His attitude, his approach, his purpose, and see how it connects with this scripture as well as, I mean, we're talking about a heritage from the Lord. Perhaps, I mean, it would also be accurate to say that they are a heritage for the Lord, given to us for safekeeping. I'm not suggesting that that's what Psalms is saying. It does say from. I'm suggesting that you could also accurately say, based on other scriptures, that children are a heritage for the Lord. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26 famously states, "Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his image, created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So we see right here at the beginning that God had a purpose that already implies a connection with his ultimate purpose with respect to the kingdom of God, which Jesus Christ in the scriptures we have already read so clearly connected. The whole purpose and the creation of man had to do with children and the importance of children on a grander scale. And I know we've talked a lot about that this past year. But there's an element of strength and dominion that was given at the very beginning. We are to have dominion in a right way over the rest of creation, rather than worshiping the rest of creation as some people would have us do. You know, it's amazing what happens when we lose sight of God and his instruction and how quickly things get turned upside down. Continuing in verse 28, "Then God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So there was an instruction at the very beginning to be fruitful and multiply. And of course, this commandment has been the butt of jokes, because it has been said that that's the only commandment that man has consistently observed. Well, up until recently, I suppose, because if you look at this clearly, it says to be fruitful and multiply, which I've teased young people that if they only have two children, they're not observing this commandment properly because they haven't multiplied yet. They have only replaced themselves. I don't know, I haven't checked to see whether the Hebrew language is that precise on the multiplication part. It's simply a way of for me to emphasize the fact that God, in contrast to our culture, values a multitude of children, and I'll have more to say about that later. Continuing in chapter 2, in verse 7, it notes that God formed man of the dust of the ground. And then we go over to, verse 21 of chapter 2. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. Then the rib which the Lord God had taken from man, he made into a woman, and he brought her to the man, and Adam said, "Wow. This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and she shall be called woman because she was taken out of the man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." So we see here that God created Adam a female counterpart with the express purpose of them becoming one flesh to conceive and to multiply and to replenish the earth. I don't see any indication here that God at any time considered children to be a bother, an impediment, a speed bump on the revered career path. Again, and it's kind of sobering when you really look at it and consider what is stated here. It's also sobering when we think about the ultimate potential of humanity. And, you know, and again, it becomes an issue of priorities, just like we read about in the Gospels, on whether or not, and how many children we have. Our culture views them as a bother or worse. That was never God's intent. God's intent was to that man would procreate and provide for him potential men and women to be born into his kingdom. That's a pretty lofty endeavor, is it not? Let's look at chapter 4. Now Adam, in verse 1, chapter 4, now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, and said, "I have gotten a man from the Lord." Or does that prove not to be the case? Well, maybe that's not an accurate statement. Cain proved not to be a man of God, although the statement, I think, is accurate that he was, that she had received a man from the Lord. Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of the sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. Dropping over to verse 25. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son, and named him Seth, for God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. Then men began to call on the name of the Lord. What is consistent in both statements here is that Eve recognized her offspring as a gift from God, a blessing. Even though the first experience was tragic. She saw at the birth of Seth, "For God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed." A blessing, a heritage from the Lord. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 2 in verse 10 and just kind of make the connection between God's creation, God's creative act, and His ultimate plan and destiny for man. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 10 talks about that. For it was fitting for Him for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the author of their salvation perfect through sufferings. So God's objective from the beginning in the creation of man was to have a basis from which to bring many sons to glory. And it is within the capacity of man to expand that possibility by observing the commandment of God or actually inhibiting it by not. And when we view it from that standpoint, like I said, it's sobering. Romans chapter 8. It's sobering, I should say, in light of our contemporary culture and also recent, shall we say, political developments. Because we're certainly going as a nation in a direction that diverges from this original intent. I mean, there are exceptions to be sure, but again, I want us to consider, because all of us are influenced by the culture in which we live. I mean, it's only natural, just like the disciples were. Today is no different. Romans chapter 8, again, just to highlight the next step, if you will, or the destiny of man, in verse 14, for as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are sons of God, for you did not receive the spirit of bondage again to fear, but you received the spirit of adoption by whom we cry out, Abba, Father. The Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. So, once born in the flesh, a child grows up and matures, and God's desire is that they become children of His. In a limited sense today, but in a very real sense ultimately, when we consider the destiny that is described here in verse 17. And if children, then heirs and heirs of God, joined heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with Him, that we may also be glorified together. So when God said that children are a heritage from the Lord, and we make the connection with what God's purpose is for mankind, we recognize just how important it is that we nurture and teach children in the way of the Lord, as we are instructed to do in Deuteronomy 30, verse 19. So it says here in verse 3 that children are a heritage from the Lord, and then the fruit of the womb is a reward. That's point number 2. Children are a reward from God. The fruit of the womb is a reward. And again, I wrote a short piece that I sent to all of you this morning with respect to, you know, where we are and how we view pregnancy and the development of children. They are certainly not seen as the fruit of the womb is not seen as a reward. On the contrary, we have now come to a point where it is argued in legal terms that contraceptives, access to free contraceptives to prevent the womb from being fruitful is an unalienable right. It is a right. And everybody should pay for that. Does that square? Is that consistent with the message of the Bible? I don't think so. Now let's go over to Genesis chapter 30 and notice, what the viewpoint was back then. Genesis chapter 30. You know, the sad thing is that, you know, you have many people that arguably shouldn't have children by the way they treat them and by the way they express them. And then on the other hand, you have people that would love to have children and can't for whatever reason. And that is truly, has always been a very difficult thing. And we notice that it's not a new phenomenon. And I don't know that the Bible is entirely clear on why God chooses, as was at least the viewpoint back then, to shut up the womb in some cases. Genesis chapter 30 and verse 1, "Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, 'Give me children or else I die.'" So she was getting really frustrated. Verse 2, "And Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel, and he said, 'Am I in the place of God, who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?'" And then, of course, the compensation began, and you know, the handmaidens, as was the custom of the day, were given to the husband in an effort to provide a surrogate mother, to use a modern term, to be able to overcome this. At that time, it was seen, you know, if you couldn't have children, it was seen as a, what's the word, disgrace. By contrast today, and again, we are in a culture where many would see that as a benefit. You know, we're free. We don't want to have children because it impedes our lifestyle. And of course, I mean, sadly, as I mentioned, there are many that would love to have children. Continuing, or let's go over to 1 Samuel and look at an example that certainly illustrates that in the Old Testament, children were seen as a reward. 1 Samuel chapter 1. I kind of dropped the story, of course, with Rachel. The story had a happy ending because in the end she had children. But over in 1 Samuel chapter 1, we have a husband and wife. Actually, the husband had two wives, and one had children and the other one didn't. Hannah was barren. So let's take a look at verse 10. "And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish, and she made a vow and said, 'O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head.' And it happened as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli watched her mouth. Now Hannah spoke in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she was drunk." And it doesn't appear that Eli was particularly perceptive. I mean, it would seem to me that it should be fairly obvious that a woman is not drunk when only her lips are moving, but maybe alcohol had a different effect back then. Usually that's not the effect. Verse 14, so Eli said to her, "How long will you be drunk? Put your wine away from you." And Hannah answered and said, "No, my lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief I have spoken until now." Then Eli answered and said, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition which you have asked of him." And she said, "Let your maidservant find favor in your sight." So the woman went her way and ate. So, we have a situation here in which Hannah made a proposition with God. "If you grant me the fruit of the womb as a reward, I will give that young boy back to you in service to you." At that time, you know, children were so desired as a blessing that she put this proposition before God. And I'd just like to point out some things that maybe we overlook. Of course, she returned home, became pregnant, and subsequently Samuel was born, a small child. And let's notice in chapter 2, her attitude about it. "And Hannah prayed and said, 'My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation.'" She could now smile at her enemies because she had a child. And we remember back in Psalm 127, it says that, you know, they're not ashamed to meet their enemies in their gates. There was confidence and strength that came from having a quiver full of children. "There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none holy beside you, nor is there any rock like our God. Talk no more so proudly, and let not arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is the God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty men are broken, and those who stumbled are girded with strength. Those who are full have hired themselves out of bread, and those who are hungry have ceased to hunger. Even the barren has borne 7, and she who has many children has become feeble." So here she is talking about someone that had been barren that bore 7, which is a number that by today's standards is huge. Again, I'll have a little bit more to say about that in my next point. But I'd like to take us over to verse 18, where Hannah, true to her promise, brought Samuel to Eli so that he could minister to God. She didn't forget. There was no contract. In the story, there's no indication that she told Eli at the time that he gave her the blessing and may the Lord grant you your request. I mean, there was no indication that she had made that public, but she kept her word, which is also something that our society no longer values. "But Samuel ministered before the Lord even as a child, wearing a linen ephod. Moreover, his mother used to make a little robe and bring it to him year by year when she came up with her husband to offer yearly sacrifice. And Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, 'The Lord give you descendants from this woman for the loan that was lent to the Lord.' Then they would go to their own home, and the Lord visited Hannah so that she conceived and bore 3 sons and 2 daughters. Meanwhile, the child Samuel grew before the Lord. So we see here that this was seen as a reward. Two more sons, three sons rather, and two daughters, for a total of six. Four sons, two daughters. Again, when you compare that to our current culture of the last 20 or 30 years, it's very different. Very different viewpoint. Point number three. Children provide protection. And, you know, you might ask, okay, you know, how does that work? You know, happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. Maybe another way to describe it would be retirement insurance. Let's go over to Deuteronomy. Let's go to Genesis chapter 22 first. Genesis chapter 22 first. In verses, let me see here. Verses 16 and forward. Here we have the story of Abraham offering up Isaac as a sacrifice, and the angel of the Lord coming, calling out to Abraham a second time after having said, do not lay your hand on the lad, etc., etc. But notice what he said, by myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing, and I have not withheld your son, your only son. In blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. And then, of course, Abraham returned. You know, what does this have to do with protection? I mean, there is strength in numbers. And, you know, with respect to, you know, one of the big issues today of retirement insurance, there is, an, I think, a very logical explanation to some of our ills economically when it comes to Social Security and Medicare. There's a very simple answer to the problem. We did not have enough kids. And no matter what some politician promises and says, the reality is you have more people taking out of it than people paying in. So there's only one solution. Either the payouts are reduced or the pay-ins are increased, and I'll let you guess which one's going to happen. And that's just a, that is just a demographic fact. And, now let me get a little bit more personal. My wife comes from a large family. Four brothers, four sisters. And, I mean, my parents-in-law are, by standards of our culture, simplistic people. But I will tell you, a man and woman of character. They started out as two people. They're going to celebrate in a few weeks their 60th wedding anniversary. So they've been around for a while. They had nine children. They now have 54 grandchildren plus or minus one or two. I may not, it's kind of hard to keep track after a while. They have 25 great-grandchildren, again, plus or minus a few. One thing I can assure you is they will never want. They will never be in want of care, because they are surrounded by a multitude of offspring, descendants, you know, not as the stars of heaven, but, I mean, when we get together, there's over 100. Well over 100, you know, when you start counting spouses. But You look at the contribution. Look at the contribution that these two individuals in Holmes County, Ohio, that ran a dairy farm their entire lives, have on the community today. And I'll just list some of the things the children and the grandchildren are doing or have done over the course of the last, 60 years. Among those 54 grandchildren and 25 great-grandchildren, there are at least two ministers, numerous business owners who employ people and have influence. There's a sawmill operator, cabinet maker, gunsmith, multiple gunsmith, actually, farmers, and their offspring has served on school boards in all different kinds of capacities, community leaders, special education. They are draftsmen, school teachers, tour guides, have served overseas in Mexico, Thailand, and Jordan. And it all started with two people 60 years ago. If you measure it by our culture standard, these two people have an 8th grade education. That's all. If you look at their career path, particularly my mother-in-law, she was a full-time mom for a long time. But what was more important? Who now has more influence, and who do you think can confidently meet their quote-unquote enemies in the gate? And I'm putting that in quotes. I mean, they haven't made enemies in their lives either. But they don't have to worry about retirement. I can assure you of that. They're of simple means. They live, as is customary among the Amish, in the so-called Dottie house next door. But there are 100 people that will make sure that they are well cared for and fed. You see, we can kid ourselves. And I will candidly admit to you that one of my regrets in life is not having had more children. And I gladly explain to you privately why that was the case. I have my reasons. I've concluded they were probably excuses. But be that as it may, our culture cannot, even in the atmosphere that we have today, overcome what God says is so. Just because we pass laws to the contrary doesn't change the universal dynamics that God set in motion. God said, be fruitful and multiply. He wasn't kidding. Oh, I didn't mention, there are also hunters, avid hunters that will go out, you know, when we talk about quivers, my nephews almost make a religion out of hunting. And it's also, I must also note this, that even they have not escaped the influence of our culture. Back in the day, you know, it was, if you didn't get married by the time you were 21, particularly if you were a girl, you know, you were in a bad way. Today, it is not unusual for, I've got a whole, stash of nephews and nieces, and they are marrying much later in life. So they haven't escaped the influence of our culture either. Point number four. Children provide happiness. That seems contradictory. And by the way, all these books, I almost forgot about my notes here. This is a, these books, and I'll put them on the information table if you care to look at them, are a compendium compiling our family histories, which is pretty complex. You know, you have here, my grandmother was a Raber. This is a compendium of the descendants of Jacob Raber, who was born in 1794, and all his lineal descendants that we know of. I mean, obviously there are those that, you know, we probably don't. I remember my grandmother telling me about the fact that, you know, young Jacob, they had lived on the border of Lake Constance, on the German side, and they bathed the young kid before they came to this country. And I had the privilege, there were enough documents left over and the address where they had lived that we were able to go look up the house that they last rented, still there. So when we talk about a heritage, you know, that's part of my family. Here I have one on the Miller side going from 1848 to 1990. If we'd update this, it would be probably three times the size. It's on the Miller side, and then, you know, it's Miller, Yoder, Raber, you know, Troyer. Michael Yoder. That's relatively small because, again, he came over here in the 19th century. And then here is a two-volume compendium. If any of you ever have an interest in looking into the development of the Amish Mennonite community that is just south of here, a guy by the name of Leroy Beach, he spent the last 20 years, this two-volume work just published this last year, spent the last 20 years compiling information from various archives and does a very good job of telling the story in narrative form. But one of the things that is part and parcel to that culture was the value of children. Let's go over to Psalms chapter 128, please. Psalm chapter 128, children are to provide happiness. Psalms chapter 128, verse 3. Your wife shall be a fruitful vine in the very heart of your house. Your children shall be like olive plants around your table. Behold, thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. You notice that in verse 2 it says, when you eat the labor of your hands, you shall be happy and it shall be well with you. How shall it be well with you? Your wife shall be like a fruitful vine. Children, according to this psalm, are to provide happiness. And if you want to see a happy tribe, you know, oblige me sometime and I'll go and introduce you to my brother-in-law, Mose Beachy. Freeman is chuckling because I think he knows the family. He is married to my wife's sister, just a year and a half younger than her, and they have 13 children. And if you want to see a happy, jolly bunch, go out to the Beachy farm. And, you know, you might think that, you know, after about number 12, the older kids would be beginning to roll their eyes and thinking, you know, isn't enough enough? Didn't occur to them. I remember well, I mean, the oldest, they have 13 children spanning an age from 28 to 2. The oldest one is Marianne, my daughter Marianne's age, and a youngest one is named Lena. And when my wife's sister was pregnant with number 13, which turned out to be Lena, we got a phone call from their oldest daughter and said, "Have you heard? Mom's pregnant again. I'm going to have another sibling." I mean, it's remarkable. All of them are well cared for. They're valued. And I will tell you, with a last name like Beachy, they're ornery as well. I mean, the Millers are all, you know, calm and collected and laid back and not fiery at all. It's the Beachy side that brings all of that to the table. His wife has been a fruitful vine, and his sons sit around the table. He's got a bunch of them, and they're happy. Large families today, except for a couple reality shows, are not celebrated. You know, they're seen as perhaps even irresponsible for bringing that many kids into this world, so much so that they become an environmental, they're seen as an environmental liability. In fact, I read an article sometime this last year in which people said, I mean, we're not going to have any kids because, you know, it would contribute to global warming. Can you imagine that? One little sunspot is going to do a lot more for the temperature of the globe than, you know, another million kids. But that's the viewpoint. That's what our culture has come to accept as fact. And I would just ask you to ponder what the source might be. What would the source be? It is none other than Satan the devil, because he does not want to see children in abundance, because he understands, perhaps better than we do, the ultimate destiny that God has in mind for these young beings. As I wrote to you this morning, since 1973, in the United States alone, over 50 million unborn have been exterminated legally. That was the stats as of 2008. So if you add roughly a million a year, give or take a few, you know, that number is considerably higher. And we will continue down that path, and there's untold millions more that have been illegally aborted. It's seen as an economic question. A first trimester abortion on average costs $461. Seems like a very good economic solution, doesn't it? I don't want a kid. It costs me $461 to get rid of the kid instead of, you know, the ridiculously calculated cost. What is the cost now to raise a kid? I think it's $150,000. I forget. I don't have that stat on top of my head. All I know is we must have done kids on the cheap because they didn't cost anywhere near that. And I'm telling you, the Beachy clan, they've been able to provide for kids for a whole lot less than that. Who would you rather be? Once you've been married for 60 years and are old. Point number 5. Children provide a sense of confidence, and we don't need to be ashamed. I'm just going to ask you to think about the scriptures that we have already looked at and realize the truism in that. My brother-in-law and my parents-in-law, they have nothing to be ashamed about. They have a sense of confidence. They're not worried about the big political issues of today. Is Social Security going to be around? Social Security, what Social Security? They have Social Security. Living, breathing, alive, caring, loving Social Security. Not some fat cat from Washington that doesn't care. And never will. And never did. Deuteronomy chapter 30. I'm going to begin reading in verse 11, and we'll just kind of ponder and comment as we go through here. Verse 11, for this commandment being all that he had previously described. Oh, I didn't read Deuteronomy chapter 28. Let's go back to that. Deuteronomy chapter 28 is one of those passages of Scripture that describe blessings and cursings. Verse 4. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body, the produce of your ground, and the increase of your herds, and the increase of your cattle, and the offspring of your flocks. The fruit of the body is described as a blessing. Verse 18. Cursed shall be the fruit of your body and the produce of your land and the increase of your cattle and the offspring of your flocks. Quite a contrast. And I might just, as we turn back over to Deuteronomy chapter 30, think about what another 50 million people under age 30 could be doing for the United States of America today. It would go a long way towards fixing Social Security. Can the U.S., does the U.S. have the resources to support another 50 million people? Absolutely. I mean, look at, just go south of here, you know, go down to Belmont County and Harrison County and Guernsey County and take a look at all the homesteads that once were vibrant little farms that have grown over. We don't have a population issue. We have a population issue, a lack of a young population to support the older generation. For this commandment, verse 11, which I command you today, it is not too mysterious for you, nor is it too far off. We don't have to understand Greek and Hebrew and complex formulas to understand what we discussed today. I just proved it to you. My mother and father-in-law, I love them dearly. They're upstanding man and woman. They can't do complex calculations. I love complex calculations. I mean, why make something simple if you can make it complicated? It's kind of my trademark, or I get accused of that. But my point is that we fail at fundamentals. You know? The law of God is simple. It can be defined in one word called love. It's kind of interesting, right? When you know, children are supposed to be conceived and cared for all in the confines of the love of two people. and a product thereof, we read it. It's not that complicated. It's not mysterious, and it's not esoteric. It's not some Eastern philosophical concept that you have to go through different orders to understand. God said that. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend into heaven for us and bring it to us that we may hear it and do it. Nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us that we may hear it and do it. You know, if only I had this knowledge, but you know, the way is too far. It's way across. It's out of my reach. We all tend to be paralyzed by what we think we can't do, by lack of resources that we don't have in an area in which we're not, and completely ignore utilizing the resources at our disposal at the time in which, during the time that God has given us. Verse 14, but the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. In that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to keep his commandments, his statutes and his judgments, that you may live and multiply. And the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go to possess. If you obey my word and multiply. Doesn't say that there's going to be an unsustainable population explosion. That's a myth. Populations are only a problem in countries in which people defy the law of God. The two are connected. It says that he will bless them. And, you know, we've seen that. My parents-in-law are blessed in every sense of the word. Oh, they're not millionaires. I don't know what their bank account looks like, but I can't imagine it would be very impressive. But they're blessed. They're secure. They have social security. But if your heart turns away so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you shall surely perish. And I tremble at the penalty this nation and others will pay for the 50 million unborn that we have exterminated. Eye for eye. It will come somehow, some way. I announce to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not prolong your days in a land which you cross over to the Jordan to go in and possess. And I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life. You know, God is always looking to give us the very best. And he knows best. I call heaven and earth as witness today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life that both you and your descendants may live. That you may love the Lord your God, that you may obey his voice, that you may cling to him. For he is your life and your length of days, that you may dwell in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. And the instruction in another passage that I won't turn to, the instruction is to teach these things to our children. While we walk by the way, while we sit in our house, every waking hour of the day, by example. By doing. Brethren, we've had a very special time today, being able to bless a child. And we've seen from the words of scriptures, five blessings that children specifically bring to the family, to the community, to the nation, to the world, and ultimately to God.